Okay, so I'm Rob McPherson. No A in the name. Anyway, from University of Victoria and the Institute of Particle Physics in Canada, I'm going to talk a bit about the LHC and getting ready for first data, what the status is, and what the time frame is as well. I'll have a very brief motivation. It seems like I could skip that. We've been waiting so long, but I would feel very guilty not doing something. So I'll have a few slides on that. Then we'll talk a bit about the status of the LHC accelerator. Then the ATLAS and CMS status. I'll primarily concentrate on the HIPT experiments. In fact, I will completely concentrate on the HIPT experiments. Then talk a bit about the prospects for this year and next year, ranging from the detector shakedown to the physics we can expect over the next 18 months or so, in 18 months of data taking. That's not to say we'll have finished the analyses by then. So just as a brief warm-up, two very, very familiar plots to all of you, I think, or most of you. There have been a generation now of extremely precise tests of the electroweak part of the standard model, probing the properties of the W and Z boson. Many measurements, primarily from LEP, the Tevatron, SLD. There's been quite reasonable agreement with the electroweak standard model. There's a few things which are running around which are a bit discrepant. Most of these are things like masses of the W or the top, widths of the W, and various asymmetries and branching ratio fractions. The agreement's quite good as long as there's a light Higgs boson. Usually, we can plot this as MW versus M-top. Here, the top mass is from the Tevatron. The W mass is from the Tevatron and LEP. And there's quite good agreement between that and the expectation by fitting for these two quantities from everything else in the standard model. These are indirect constraints. They overlap quite nicely. These are 68% confidence level limits from a few months ago, the last fits. If the Higgs is light, this is 114 GeV Higgs, which is just right at the experimental bound from LEP 2. Higher mass Higgs, of course, are strongly disfavored. We usually plot that in this blue band plot, where only the Higgs is left as a free parameter, and everything else is taken as measurements from the different experiments. A delta chi-squared plot versus the Higgs mass. The minimum right now is about 90 GeV. The direct search from LEP is the yellow region at 114 GeV. Combining those and integrating out probabilities up this curve, the Higgs, if it's a standard model Higgs, should still be less than about 200 GeV, 190 GeV, 95% confidence level. This bounces around a little bit, but not really a lot anymore. It's always less than about 200 GeV. Clearly, our strong interest then is to find the standard model Higgs if it exists. If we don't see it, we still have to explain what's running around in all that precision electroweak, all those precision electroweak measurements somehow. So there might be some strong dynamics. Those have a certain amount of trouble if there's no Higgs. If there is a Higgs, there's still the annoyance of fine-tuning the Higgs mass if no new physics kicks in by some scale, usually taken as the TeV scale. We have different alternatives for fixing this. We can try to cancel the loops that lead to those fine-tuning problems in models like supersymmetry, or try to cut off the theory at the terascale by introducing strong gravitational interactions there, say, or something else. Now, can we guess what the new physics is? I like to think of the situation leading to the standard model itself, where from processes like these with the four Fermi contact interaction and knowledge of QED and things like that, they were able to deduce what happened, what an underlying model, which is certainly more compelling, not just, of course, things like the charge current, but also by unifying with electromagnetism, infer a neutral current, which was discovered, predict properties of the W and Z, which were then measured very precisely and in quite good agreement with the model, as we saw in a few slides ago. It's not as obvious that we have such a compelling model of new physics today. Maybe the hints are there and we're not seeing it, or maybe things are a bit less obvious. I don't know if there are such smoking guns as there were 40 years ago. Certainly, Higgs mass fine-tuning seems to beg for terascale physics. It doesn't really tell us what. Small neutrino masses large neutrino mixing, it's not at all obvious that there's any ties with this. It may be something completely different. A few hundred GeV dark matter seems just tantalizingly close to where we want new physics from the teriscale. Maybe these things are connected via something like supersymmetry or some other solution to the Higgs fine-tuning problem with a cold dark matter candidate. We, of course, have the problem of this light Higgs and all of the precision measurements from B physics, K physics, rare muon decays that we have to take into account. So what's the next project, especially a terascale project? Well, we need solid Higgs coverage to certainly this 200 GeV limit we can treat with a bit of a grain of salt. The Higgs sector might be more interesting than that. Solid Higgs coverage to a TeV or so. We should find whatever particle is running around in those loops and the precision measurements so we can infer its existence. See if it's really a minimal center model Higgs by measuring its properties, or see if it's something else. We need to be sensitive to any new physics up to, well, as high an energy scale as we can reach, certainly up to the TeV scale or few TeV. SUSY's a favorite model. We'll ensure complete coverage of this, although personally I've always taken SUSY as a good way to couple to things like cold dark matter, especially if our parity is conserved in supersymmetry. And then we need very good hermetic so-called detectors. That just means good missing energy resolution to make sure if there's any missing energy in events that might be from a cold dark matter candidate, that we can differ from the missing energy in the standard model, which is neutrinos. It could be something completely different. If it's responsible for electroweak symmetry breaking or related to it, hopefully it decays via at least some component via electroweak couplings, and then we can see that the decay products, such as W's and Z's, and their decay products themselves. So that leads us into the Large Hadron Collider. You're probably all quite familiar with this, a 27-kilometer circumference pair of rings, actually, in the same magnetic field, which intersect at into four experimental areas. I'll only talk about ATLAS and CMS, which are probing this terascale, the very high PT region. So this is probably the best page. It's from the CERN homepage that you can follow if you want to see where the LHC is right now, which is the cooling of the dipole of the magnets, the cooling of the different octants. There's eight sectors or octants in the LHC. There's a color code here which you can't quite read, but this very light blue means 2 Kelvin, which is superfluid helium, which is the temperature that the magnets are meant to run at. Currently, there are four sectors there of the eight. Three sectors, which are the darker blue ones, those are cooling down at some stage or another. This red sector, sector 4-5, has just started cooling, actually, at the very end of last week, so it's still in red, near room temperature still, just about. This is the one that previously had this so-called inner triplet problem. These final focusing quadrupoles had a very bad experience when they underwent an asymmetric loading test. There's been a lot of work done on them and fixes applied to them at the other interaction points, well, primarily here. And then the sector was warmed up and the fix is made, and it's now about to start cooling down. They nevertheless did quite a few powering tests of the magnets on sector 4-5 and sector 5-6 here. This is a snapshot. It's slightly out of date, but it shows you how they start cooling down various sectors. It's been taking these ones. This is slightly out of, this is only 28th of April here. So they had where a couple of the sectors had just started cooling. These ones took the last few before that about 6 weeks, and they're compressing it down to about 4 weeks to cool down one sector of the LHC. They're not limited. There are a lot of discussions of limits of helium and things, but it doesn't seem to be a fundamental problem. So right now, they're cooling, but also doing a lot of powering tests, both of the sector that had the inner triplet problem that they warmed up, and also this sector 5-6. They achieved magnet currents, especially in the dipoles, equivalent to nearly 6 TeV, greater than 5.5 TeV beam energies without any problems. Then when they tried to ramp the current up to the equivalent of 7 TeV, they had some quenches, which they didn't expect, actually. So they're trying to understand exactly what happened. Right now, it seems to be limited to a few batches of magnets from one, or even one batch from one manufacturer. So it's a little better than the situation was even a few weeks ago. So it's a limited number of magnets they have to retrain, probably. Nevertheless, the current plan is to run at root S equals 10 TeV this year. Then in the shutdown, they'll finish retraining the magnets to turn on next year in 2009 at root S equals 14 TeV, the nominal energy. This is actually a plug for Canadian contributions to the LHC. We had a few, but since this conference is in Canada, I'll mention that we built kicker systems, which take beam from this transfer line from the SPS and kick it into the LHC. And these tests are now ongoing, and the systems, the whole accelerator, indeed, seems to be on track for successful operation. Just a snapshot of the program now. These are the different sector indices. So there's eight. They go IP1 or 0.1 to 0.2 is how they're labeled, etc. So this this four cold. I think this one's cold. That one's wrong. That line's wrong. So four sectors are cold. The one that's really was latest is this one that had the inner triplet problem. So it's just started cooling now. They expect to have all sectors cold in late June or early July. They like to stabilize it for a week or two. And then by mid-July, they're kicking us out of the experimental areas completely. We can't be in there when there's beam in the machine. Shortly after that, by the end of July, just before that perhaps, they'll have first particles, well, injected actually, they're already doing now, but circulating, I should have written here. And commissioning with beam, and even collisions at injection energy starts. After about two more months of commissioning, there's certainly uncertainty on that. They hope to be at about 10 TeV with collisions. And by November, they may reach 10 to the 32 luminosity per centimeter squared per second. We'll take probably most of the data this year, ramping up to 10 to the 31, and they'll try to get to about 10 to the 32 by the end of the year, if they can. We'll integrate a few tens of inverse picobarns, maybe 100, 150 inverse picobarns, if we're really lucky, at about 10 TeV this year. Probably next year, about an inverse femtobarn. So I'll just mention a bit about the status of ATLAS and CMS. So this is CMS. System integration has been ongoing. These are milestones, basically, as a function of month last year. So by the end of 2007, they had integrated a significant fraction of the experiment, including the high-level trigger system and all the sub-detectors as well. So that looks quite promising. They can take data at full rates or nearly full rates with the whole system, not with collisions yet, of course. But the detector looks good for first collisions. This is a snapshot of using cosmic ray muons, which penetrate the Earth and go through the detector, looking at just some residuals, hit residuals in the one of the muon layers. And already this is about 300 micron single hit resolution with cosmic rays is not a bad position to be starting in at all. ATLAS is doing the same thing. Cosmic ray muons coming through the Earth, running through the detector, which are triggered on. If you perhaps can make out this track coming through here, through the muon systems, the Hadron calorimeter, which are scintillate tiles, the electromagnetic barrel in this case, and the inner tracker system, and a blow up of this region facing the detector end on. This is from the side. The beam axis runs through here. This is just one snapshot of ATLAS commissioning activities with the calorimeter system. The numbers of good channels varies a bit, but for example, in the critical EM barrel of 170,000 channels, about 0.04% of them are problematic. So that's very good. There's, of course, a lot of redundancy built into the 170,000. There's a couple of snapshots here. For example, this comes out barely. The red dots are points on the, this is just a pulse shape from one single channel in the electromagnetic barrel. The points are from cosmic ray muon data, and the line you probably can't make out is from our inferred from our electronics calibration system and electronics modeling. But the agreement is very good. This plot over here shows the response to muons in one layer, one of the electromagnetic calorimeter. This is, I should have labeled, this is plotted as a function of eta. Eta means this is basically angle from the beam axis. Zero is perpendicular to the beam. And by the time you get to somewhere out here, you're along the beam axis, well, it's infinity technically, but by 4, 3, 4, 5, you're pretty close to the beam. This is the 0.8 means you're still in the barrel. The deviations from our Monte Carlo simulation of cosmic muons to our measurements are about 2%. So that's not a bad position to be starting in either. I'll mention a bit about plans for early data taking. Our goals for physics, numbers like 1% or better, ECal uniformity better, actually. Lipton energy scales, the 0.1%, et cetera. Uniformity in the HCal, also good. Jet energy scale to a percent, which is quite ambitious, and tracking resolutions. This is where we seem to be moving, maybe even a bit better than this in some scales, at the beginning before we start taking data at all. So I'll show you a bit about why we think we're doing all right. I've already shown you some of that, actually. So the timeline from day zero, that's what I'm calling this year, is to complete the detector calibrations, find tracking alignment in the inner detectors and also the muon systems, understanding the lepton scales and muon momentum scales, tune up B tagging as fast as we possibly can. Inner detector alignment, for example, is critical. We'll move into a program of first standard model physics measurements. Underlying event will be absolutely critical, understanding that at 14 TeV. Demonstrate the ability to measure critical standard model processes, especially near regions which might have new physics in them, and then move to first searches beyond the standard model. This is just a snapshot to keep in mind. It's been changing a bit over time. Expected luminosity in inverse femtoburns versus year. So this year will be somewhere in the, it's hard to know exactly, but let's say 100 inverse picobarns, although at 10 TeV, not 14. By next year, think about around an inverse femtobarn at 14 TeV, and then, of course, it ramps up. But the line back here is very speculative. This is a luminosity-upgraded LHC program, the SLHC, after a shutdown in around 2015 or 2016. So at the beginning, we'll do things like CT-bar, and then the first kinds of new physics we might have some sensitivity to, well, a Z-prime with leptonic decays, that would be quite nice. It would be quite easy to see. Perhaps lower scale SUSY, easier to discover Higgs channels, and then harder Higgs channels, and then maybe more speculative models a bit farther down the road. Of course, these timelines are for the actual data acquired, not to finish the analyses and publish them. So just the environment we're working in and the kinds of signals we'll be seeing. This is a old cross-section plot, but let's look over here. So per inverse femtobarn, that means by the end of, let's say, 2009 data taking, it'll be about a tenth of this, perhaps, if we do okay this year, if we're lucky. So here you see 10 million Ws, perhaps approaching a million even this year. Very good calibration source. Zs, a million, maybe it's 100,000 or less this year. Quite a few tops, 100,000 tops here. With muon, these are all with muon decay mode, so easy, relatively easy to trigger on and reconstruct for inverse femtobarn. Down here, things like minimum bias events or nearly zero bias events, it can be as large as we want. It's limited by trigger prescales. These are assuming some trigger matrix. Something like supersymmetry at TeV scale with blue enodes around the TeV, with this kind of data set, we'll see on the order of, depends of course on the point in SUSY space, 100,000 of them in principle, if we can see them. So one of the first things we'll do are our tractor alignment. Our minimum bias samples can be very useful for that at almost any center of mass energy. Something with a lot of muons in it, like W or Z, is good because it has low multiple scattering in the inner detector system, and we also need it to couple the inner detector to our muon systems. Ultimately, we'll have fancier techniques, but initially, we'll do something like fit a track, drop a point, fit the other points on the track, and took a residual. This has already been done in Cosmics. This is just one example from Atlas, where our surveying system and hardware alignment systems predicted a particular residual for the inner detector system. We were able to measure with Cosmics something that was within cosmic ray muons, within about 10 microns of that. So that's already quite a good place to be starting from. I was always pessimistic about doing B tagging early on, but our work with Cosmic seems to indicate that maybe it'll be all right. And we can iterate this with even a few 10 inverse picobarns is enough to do quite a good job. The ECal uniformity is very important. One way to check that is with minimum bias events, extrapolating something like an electron, even a charged pion, although those have some other problems, into the electromagnetic calorimeter, predict how much energy we should see and measure it, and iterate it to get uniformity. We can quickly, at least in the barrel regions of the detector, which are the cleanest regions, approach 1% or so with rather little beta. It's a few days of data taking at what we used to call low luminosity, 10 to the 33, but perhaps in 2008 we'll approach this kind of level quite by the end of the year, at least have the data to do it. Electromagnetic scale and muon scale, sorry, electron and muon energy scales are critical for most of our measurements. One standard candle we have is the Zed, which already gets us out to a 91 GeV object. It has high rate and good coverage in the detector. We can also use radiative Zed decays for photon energy scale measurements, albeit at slightly lower energies. So just an example from Zed to EE, you can take a calorimeter and split it into towers of any size you like, down to the readout granularity in A test. So this is roughly a theta coordinate from the beam axis and phi. So take these so-called towers, and each one of those towers we assume needs some correction to do with things like dead material in the inner detector in front of it, things like that, that we don't have quite right in our Monte Carlo, so we need to calibrate it to get an absolute scale. So, well, using the standard candle, it's not quite so simple. A given tower has an energy which gets fudged from our expectation by some correction factor. But to use a standard candle like this, in fact, you have to compute a mass of the Z in this case, and then these alphas, two of them enter in. So for every pair of towers we reconstruct Z to EE in, we have some correction factor, and we fit for all of those pairs of these alpha I and alpha J, which we lump into something called beta in the next plot I'll show you. So here's some fits for beta versus injected beta, where this means we've miscalibrated the Monte Carlo in some systematic way, and then tried to see, and rather pessimistic way, and see if we can recover the actual performance of the calorimeter using this Monte Carlo, which is faking data which isn't calibrated correctly. So for example, probably the plot to look at is this one, where we can get better than a percent with 1 to 200 inverse picobarn. So that's the kind of data set we're hoping to get in 2008 or by early 2009. This is with rather fat towers, 0.2 to 0.4 means that's quite a bit bigger than an electron actually. But that will make the towers smaller as we get more and more data, and it's just limited by statistics. So another thing we need to do is a jet energy scale. We have several different handles on that. One way is to use a W, in the same way we used the Z earlier for electrons, so W to jet-jet. We form an invariant mass of the jet pairs, again in energy eta and phi bins. We can do this with somewhat lower statistics in principle than electrons because the jet is already a big object, so we don't need to go down to finer tower granularity. So we compare, in this particular study, energy of the parton to energy of the jet, again with miscalibrated Monte Carlo and then an iterative technique to see if we can recover the detector performance. We have a few different, somewhat slightly lower statistics could make the red points, which are a parametrized calibration, and something that uses exactly the same brute force method as I showed you for electrons gives you the black method. With the 30 inverse picobarn, so something we can expect this year, we're coming down to percent level statistical precision at least. We don't really know all the systematics that'll be in this yet, of course. So this is reconstructing the W mass, and these are backgrounds expected. It's quite a clean channel. For the top mass, that'll be one of the earliest analyses we try to do. We worry a lot about early B tagging, jet energy scale, especially B jets, and any detector problems. The uncertainty on the B jet energy scale is absolutely critical for getting the top mass right. Of course, the top decays to BW, and then the W goes to either two light jets or lepton neutrino. We classify the different decay modes by the W pair of W decays, but the Bs are always there. For example, if we start off with a 10% error on the B-jet energy scale, that's already 7 GeV systematic on the top mass. This is just a sketch of that, the scale on the B-jet energy versus the top mass versus the scale on the B-jet energy. So this is, keep in mind numbers like this for systematics. The statistical precision quickly becomes competitive with that. With 30 inverse, where do we go? So the most important backgrounds are Ws. We have simple selections that we think will work at the beginning. Select just things like high PT jets to sort of combinatorics. the plot here, the W mass and the Z mass, sorry, the W mass and the top mass here, and with even 30 inverse picobarns, so something we really hope we could try to get this year, of course, the slightly different center of mass energy, the top mass statistical precision is about 3 GeV. Already pretty, even at this point, we'll probably be initially systematics limited. And certainly if we get to, say, 150 inverse picobarns, the statistical error in the top mass, even with no B tagging, is less than a GeV. So here we'll really, this is not to say we're going to do this. This is to say we'll be systematics limited for sure by this point. We'll have to understand it, or use this to help us understand the detector. One of the backgrounds, not the BJT energy scale, but something that's quite hard to get right, are the combinatorics. The background, there's two types. One is, this is the non-top background, but even the top background has large tails due to combinatorics. We actually can help with B-tagging, we get a lot of help on combinatorics, so that helps a lot. If we can turn on B-tagging early, we can get rid of a lot of our systematics from the beginning. For example, two B-tags, the red points at the top, with 30 inverse picobarns, no, 150 inverse picobarns, and it's quite a clean signature, where we can initially, one thing we can do is use this to measure the BJ energy scale, but of course that doesn't really help us if we want to then turn around and measure the top mass. An early search that we'll do is Z prime to something like EE or mu mu, where we think we can do electrons and muon scales and identification quite quickly. Even with rather little beta, we'll start to see peaks. If our trigger thresholds are what we hope they can be, that we'll have to see, we can get, even with one inverse picobarn, we start to get quite a few J-psis and upsilons, and even Zs as well. These are very nice standard candles for lower masses and reasonable masses, nearly 100 GeV for the Z. Then, of course, we look in the tail up here at higher masses to see if there are any other peaks out there. So, for example, with 70 inverse picobarns, in principle, we can discover a TeV scale, Z prime. It depends on the cross-section, of course. You have to plug in some model. And this is just a plot of different mass Z primes, but you can take 70 inverse picobarns, so perhaps we could get to somewhere near that this year. There's a TeV, but it falls off quite quickly, and we need more data than supersymmetry. That's a favorite model for something, because it can have quite high cross-sections. Strongly interacting particles, so if squarks or gluinos are low enough in scale to be produced at the LHC, we can have quite a high cross-section, good candidate for early discovery. Sleptons in the decays let us trigger on these guys. Missing energy, assuming something like our parity conservation, is, of course, a great signature, assuming we can see that experimentally. So there are many high PT objects observed. The critical thing is ET miss, assuming whether or not you believe in supersymmetry. We have some new physics which is related to the production of dark matter candidate particles. Then if they're 100 GeV-ish dark matter candidates or higher, hopefully we can see them as missing energy in some sort of cascade chain at the LHC. Doing these analyses with missing energy will be very difficult, particularly estimating the ET miss backgrounds. So types of signatures, well, I said this already, leptons, jets with missing energy. These are the kinds of standard model backgrounds, Ws, TT bar, and also QCD. The greatest discrimination power comes from missing energy, but it's hard to model. It's really in the Monte Carlos. A generic approach, we don't have an absolutely rigorous way to get these out of just out of the data for all channels. We still have some reliance on Monte Carlo. It's a bit worrying. For QCD, we try to measure tails in the low ET miss region and extrapolate it. That's fine. And then that's a bit non-trivial. I'll just show you one example with, this is actually not QCD, this is from electroweak backgrounds like Zeds and UNU, where in old, this is an ancient plot now, but a SUSY signal with a TeV SUSY scale compared to backgrounds looks like it stands out. But if you throw in something like AlpGen, I know there are members of the audience that know about AlpGen much more than I do, but it's an attempt to take a more precise theory prediction calculation of the matrix element part of a process, which then starts to overlap with what think programs like Pythia do for a parton shower part of the process, and you try to drop out overlapping terms. But with some first attempt to do Z to nu nu plus jet, you start to see something that looks an awful lot more than, so this is the expected SUSY signal, a lot like the expected SUSY signal, unfortunately. That means we really, really would like either a really good estimate on the error bars associated with these predictions, or some way to extract backgrounds from data. For Zeds, it's maybe not so bad. For Zeds, we have Z goes to EE or mu mu is a fairly analogous process to Z goes to nu bar. And unfortunately, the branching ratios are lower on the charged lepton side. But nevertheless, we can measure Z to mu or EE plus jets and correct for branching ratio fractions and acceptance and try to use that to predict this process purely with data. So down here, the black points are Z to nu bar, and then the red points are or blue points are the extrapolation from Z to LL. And for quite a lot of the region, it seems like we can do this. It falls off with statistics because of the branching ratios, unfortunately, at some point. I'll just make one comment on the Higgs before finishing. This is a Higgs branching ratio plot, but you know, up to about 100 GeV or a bit higher, BB bar dominates. Eventually, you get to WWZZ dominating, and the current limit is somewhere in the middle. If it's a higher mass Higgs, let's say greater than 130 or greater than 140 GeV, then 4 leptons, which is Z star goes to 4 leptons, starts to become a nice peak over the background. This plot's with 10 inverse Bempel barns, so not something you're going to see in the next couple of years. But with one inverse Bempel barn, we're down to doing, again, you know, two or three golden event type searches for a Higgs like this. It's not how we want to discover something, but we might get a first indication, even with the 2009 data, if we're lucky, and if it's something like ZZ star goes to 4 leptons. I'll just comment that lower mass Higgs is 120 GeV. They're difficult. There's three channels which contribute almost equally, say two sigma with 10 inverse femto barns for 120 GeV Higgs or so. Gamma gamma, this is TT bar where the Higgs goes to BB bar now and the tops decay to BW. Or this is called vector boson fusion. WZ makes the Higgs goes to tau tau and you see low angle jets. These have different experimental problems. I'm much more optimistic about the EM energy scale and the B tagging now, actually, given our commissioning results. This is still hard because a tau is a narrow jet somewhere with one or three tracks, which is difficult. So the lower mass Higgs will be difficult, and it's not just a luminosity question. So I think I'm out of time. So just to summarize, our first priority with early LHC collisions will be to push the detectors, understand them, dead and hot channels, and our calibrations and energy scales. Do basic standard model measurements, parton distribution functions, and things like Zs and Ws and tops. We'll do our first searches, perhaps if we're really lucky this year's data, but probably next year's data for Z primes and supersymmetry. As much as possible, relying on data-driven background estimates until we can get good predictions of some of these backgrounds with real error bars on them. For standard model Higgs, if we're lucky, if it's greater than 140 GeV, we could see it relatively early. Lighter might take time, actually, to finish. So that's all. So there's some microphones here. If you could try to speak into them, or we'll repeat the questions.
Any questions, comments from the speaker?
There's one right here. No.
What is your nightmare scenario? What will go completely wrong in the next few months?
Art, what is the
nightmare scenario? What will go completely wrong in the next few months?
Well, it takes 1 month, even 6 weeks, to warm up one of these sectors and 4 weeks to cool down a sector. So if they find any more problems, it's a complicated machine. It might be a very minor problem that for some reason that we haven't seen yet. That's one reason people really want to do these injection circulation tests as quickly as possible. Then we lose two months. 2.5 months, and that may lose the run this year, for example. So the nightmare, a real nightmare, I really hope doesn't happen, but even a very small problem, if it requires warming up, it takes 2.5 months to warm up and cool down, and then whatever time is spent fixing the problem. So we could lose the run this year if another one of these problems, which, you know, there's been a few, mostly they make the press, and they usually turn out to be not nearly as bad as the first reports, but nevertheless, to warm up and cool down, we'd probably lose any one sector would probably lose the run this year.
More questions? I got a question concerning the last slides on the light Higgses.
Yeah.
Do you think we will see Higgs to BB bar, TD bar Higgs to BB bar? What's the current status on that one?
This one's not so bad because it has four B tags. because so this is this you know so-called open top mode. So here each of these tops goes to B, W. One of the W's might go leptonically and the other hadronically to still reconstruct. And in that case, with four B tags, yeah, it's certainly possible. If it's only two B tags, it's really difficult. It's really difficult to see it with two B tags. Just from the QCD backgrounds are very, very high. But if we have four Bs, plus maybe one of these top goes to W and we have a lepton over here, that we can do. So this particular diagram, I think, is okay with a certain amount of work on making sure the B tags are all really understood. So that one's okay because of the four B tags. With two B tags, it's really difficult because of the QCD background.
One more question?
There have been reports from the Tevatron-Higgs working group and the CERN-Higgs working groups that they're much more accurate top mass versus MW, that the Higgs mass is being pushed to lower values. And you mentioned that, but they significantly low values. Also, there have been blog reports that the Tevatron has excluded the Higgs mass up to 160 GeV, 2.5 times the standard model expectation.
So on the first point, I can just go back to the last combination, which is from Morion, basically, of all the current released Tevatron data at that time, which it certainly is not excluded. I mean the 95% confidence level limit is 190 GeV. So at least, I mean, that's a limit. I mean, it's certainly true that the best fit value is below the exclusion for the standard model Higgs. It's 87 GeV. But as you know, I guess it's a log scale, so it goes up quite slowly. So the actual exclusion is limit is still completely compatible with it existing being less than 200 GeV. It moves around a bit, but on the log scale, it's really hard to exclude out to these high masses. Regarding this exclusion from the Tevatron you're mentioning and the direct search, I don't work at the Tevatron. I've heard rumors. We'll see some results from the Tevatron. I think it's on Thursday, Wednesday, in Brigitte Vachon's talk. But I can't really comment on that myself.
Okay, I guess we better move on to the next speaker. Let's thank
No,
Professor McPherson again.